Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
101.9 Chai FM, I'm Benji Shulman, and this is Plus972 Studio, your best Jewish current affairs and culture show. And we've got a great one lined up for you today. I hope that you are excited to be with it, as I am. But on the cool side today, we had lots and lots of rain previously, and now suddenly we have the sun out, but it's kind of cold. I wonder if winter is starting to approach. I've just seen a few of the trees. They have the leaves that are going a little bit brown. Not quite autumn yet, but definitely a little bit more of a chill in the air. I don't know if it's the start of something or just it is something else. We will, I guess, find out. So what do we have up on the show for you today? So many interesting things. We're going to be talking about something you may or may not have heard about called the Hague Group. What is the Hague Group? Well, we're going to be finding out what is it and why it matters. We're going to be talking about Iran, as that is something which is continuing. And we're going to be looking at non-kinetic regime change options for the regime in Tehran. What does that mean? Well, we're going to be finding out what it means exactly, because there is a suggestion that it might be difficult to bomb a country into submission. So what are your other options if you don't want to put boots on the ground? That is the real question. So that is the second one. We're going to be looking in, opening up the hood and looking at the new DA leadership race. What does it look like? What might it mean for the future of the party? That is an important question. And then we're also going to be talking about the late Musiwa Tera Lakota. He died last week. I believe there's a state funeral for him coming up next week, or on Saturday, if I'm not mistaken. And we're going to be looking at his life. He led a very, very remarkable life, and the impact that he had on really the world, on South Africa, and on our own community as well. So those are all things that are coming up in the next hour. And as part of it, we really want you to be part of the discussion, because, you know, we want to hear what you have to say, and it's always good to hear what you have to say. So if you do want to be part of the conversation, 061-895-1019. That is your WhatsApp line, 061-895-1019. And we will happily take whatever it is that you can throw at us. Compliments, cautions. We haven't gotten too many death threats recently, Craig. So, you know, maybe you can pop a couple of those on to the WhatsApp line as well. And it should be extremely interesting. So I'm certainly looking forward to it.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
101.9 Chai FM, I'm Benji Shulman, and this is Studio Plus 972. And let's get into what is big in the world today. And I wanted to talk about this issue of the Hague Group, because I suspect that most people haven't heard about it. It's one of those nebulous international relations organization things that you find in the international community from time to time. And most people just ignore it. Maybe it's just another one of these UN community things. What does it actually mean? So we thought we would get into it, because actually it's a lot more insidious than that. So what is the Hague Group? So it's only popped up in the last couple of years, and it's being touted by the people who created it as being a way of using international law or supporting international law around the world. It was created by Colombia and by South Africa, and they have been pushing to get more and more members on to this thing. And it's, as I said, it's supposedly a way of dealing with international law. But as it got more and more engaged and doing more and more things, you started noticing what the real agenda was. And unsurprisingly, because it is South Africa and the very left-wing grouping in Colombia, what it started to do was say things about basically targeting Israel in the international arena. And essentially, what they're trying to do is create an alternative structure to some of the dispute resolution mechanisms inside the UN, and rather create a punitive structure that will target Israel and its allies, including the United States. So a couple of years ago, we started seeing some of the things that they were intending to do. So there was discussions about blocking access to ports for Israeli ships. There were some other things that they were doing on the international level. And so there's that kind of thing at the beginning. And to be honest, initially, a lot of people didn't really take it particularly seriously. There were very few countries that were involved. And most of the countries, and still most of the countries that are involved, don't have any relations with Israel anyway. And so it was kind of seen as a fringe lobby group. It was an interesting thing because the South Africans were supposed to be having important dialogue with the United States. I remember when it was launched, and just as it was launched, Cyril Ramaphosa was supposed to be speaking to Trump, I think, which was highly embarrassing. And I think he even tried to walk it back some of the stuff on Twitter, more or less unsuccessfully. But basically, South Africa has launched this, and it's sort of running on its merry way. And I think the reason that the South Africans are doing this is because parts of the UN system are failing to, first of all, to deal with problematic entities, and second of all, have been captured entirely. And so they are trying to create an alternative. South Africa, for example, has been part of BRICS. And BRICS is an economic grouping that was designed to get around established finance institutions like the IMF, for example. And so they've been building an alternative financial infrastructure so that they can do payments inside the BRICS system, and then they don't have to operate, for example, on the SWIFT system, which is a system that can be used to do payments in things that are not dollars, for example. So basically, you've got these countries that don't want to work in the international system. They don't want to work through the United Nations Security Council, for example, because the Security Council has five permanent members. Those members are the UK, America, Russia, China, and France. Yes, probably France. And these are the countries that is it France? Actually, cannot remember. If you know, please 061-895-1019. I cannot remember who the fifth member of the Security Council is. That is very embarrassing. Anyway, nonetheless, the point is that if you look at the wars that we've been having recently, you would see that, for example, when Russia then invades Ukraine, Russia has a veto on any resolution that's taken to deal with that problem. So that's a huge issue. Then there's another. That now we have this issue with Iran. So if people, China, for example, then brought this to the Security Council, China, America would no doubt veto it. And America vetoes regularly, kind of more importantly than this, resolutions that are brought against Israel at the Security Council as the important vote there in the international system. So South Africa has gotten frustrated with this and is now trying to build this alternative to the Security Council that it will use then to target Israel in the international community. And they're being pretty explicit about this. So, for example, it was reported, I think, in the Jewish Report that basically the council, the Hague group, wants to make what they call, literally using the word selective justice when it comes to international law. So they don't want international law to apply equally to all states. What they want to do is create a set of international law that could then be used specifically against Israel for crimes that they've decided are actually crimes, even if they're not. And then from there, that wouldn't apply to other countries. So we saw the Hague group last week having an emergency meeting on the 4th, and basically there were 40 countries in attendance. As I said, majority of them were countries that are already have a kind of anti-Israel agenda anyway, but they are There were others. There was like Switzerland, which is kind of a weird one to be there. There were a couple of African countries, some of which are quite friendly with Israel, people like Ghana on Ivory Coast and these sorts of things. So there were some worrying characters as part of it. But some of them have also actually started removing themselves from the process. So Honduras, for example, actually left the grouping after this last group. And I think it's because it's becoming more and more obvious what this is all about. And in fact, they're not even hiding it at the moment. The woman who heads it up, I think who's, I can't quite remember what her role actually is, but she was, I don't know, former foreign minister or something like that, or part of a big NGO network or something like that. But she basically is very specific that this forum is now in place to try and boycott and target Israel. And one of the things that they did in this process is that they took a resolution that these countries would do extra screening for Israelis coming through the borders so that they could check supposedly for war crimes or whatever, but really it's just a harassment technique. Now, in a South African context, for example, that would be very difficult to do because the DIRCO can take that resolution if they want, but the people who actually handle the ports and everything in that respect is Home Affairs, and Home Affairs is run by the DA. So they wouldn't have to, you know, they wouldn't have to comply necessarily with what DIRCO is signing on to in some treaty somewhere. So the question is, well, then what does this mean? Why should we care and or worry about this? Because, you know, clearly it doesn't have an actual impact. And for that, one of the things that they have started to do is they're talking about basically domesticating this international agreement into our local laws. So you might remember that last year we saw the institution of this so-called apartheid bill. And that bill was basically designed to target Israel locally, cut off connections, cut off supplies, cut off all these sorts of things. And effectively what this group is hoping to do is get that model applied across the world, lots of countries applying it. Here in South Africa, it's been done as a private members bill. It hasn't really gone anywhere yet, and it's something I sort of have to keep watching. But effectively, that is what they want to do, is get these 40 countries to actually go ahead and do this and start driving this particular agenda, which will be a very interesting one if they try and do it. So that is the Hague Group, and it is something that we're going to have to watch because literally the apartheid analogy is core to everything that it does, and we'll have to see where it actually ends up. The other thing which is very interesting is that Paraguay, which is another South American country, has actually joined the International Court of Justice case. And what Paraguay is saying is that they actually are upset with the ICJ and certain countries like Ireland because they have applied, as well as NGOs, to have the definition of genocide relaxed, widened, increased, so that specifically so that they can target Israel at the ICJ. And Paraguay has come out and said, look, the definition of genocide is what it is. You can't go around convicting people of things if you're just changing the definition all the time. But it shows you that these people can't really get anywhere on the genocide question. And so now they're trying to widen it out. But this is a new front that is happening in the international community. And it's something that we're going to have to be watching very, very carefully. I'm Edgy Shulman. This is 101.9 Chai FM.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is Plus927 Studio. And we are talking again about key things going on around the world. So obviously Iran has now, we're a week and a half in, and there's questions that are starting to emerge about what might happen with Iran and the regime. And the reason that these questions are happening is people are not really sure what will actually occur, right? They killed the Ayatollah, the leader, the supreme leader of Iran. And the point is that the regime is actually very ensconced and entrenched in the country, and it has the ability to survive a certain amount of let's call it redundancy, right? You have other leaders who come up, and basically it seemed, or has seemed like, Trump's view of this thing was that he was going to do a Venezuela type thing where he would find someone who would just listen to him. He took Maduro, and then he basically dealt with the deputy. And so far, that arrangement seems to have worked. So unfortunately, Venezuela doesn't get proper democracy, but it does end up with a less violent and threatening group in charge. And I think from the Americans' perspective, also someone who will sell them their oil. So that is a something that is going on. And I think that Trump was wanting to try that again for Iran, especially because it's one thing to do what the Americans have done, which is take out thousands of these targets along with the Israelis. But bombing itself is a very difficult way to control a population. There's been very, very few examples where people have sort of changed, or the leadership has sort of changed just through a bombing campaign. You really sort of had to put boots on the ground. And in America, that might require acts of Congress. It might require a lot of political will. It's a midterm election. And the rule in American elections is that if you want to stay in power, you should have no wars abroad and the economy should be booming. And at the moment, Trump has neither of those things, according to the American data. And that's a huge, huge problem that he needs to deal with. And certainly getting people to invade Iran would be very difficult, far more difficult than Iraq. And that was like hundreds of thousands of troops. Iran is very mountainous. It's kind of cut off from a lot of places. It's 90 million people. It's widespread geographically. They don't like people from outside. So it would be difficult to do with just boots on the ground. And although there's been a lot of good work done to take out the nuclear sites, which is the first thing that Trump wanted, and then to take out the ballistic missile sites, where there's been a big improvement on that side of things, and then to try and bankrupt the regime so it doesn't rebuild Hezbollah, etc. These things Trump is starting to get done. But the last part, which is basically how do you stop this happening again, is a particular problem. And so what we're going to look at today is what are those options for the Americans if this is going ahead. But before we tackle that, I have some messages that have come in on the WhatsApp line. So thank you, Austin Gibbs, who messaged us last week. And if you want to be part of that conversation, 061-895-1019. And Austin has said the following. He says, "Hi, Benji, looking forward to another great show. This has become a rock in my diary for listening and information." From Austin. Thank you, Austin. And has also said to me that the five main members are, we were talking about the Security Council, China, France, Russia, Ukraine, and America. So I got that right. And he's also asked, what are your thoughts on the Abraham Accords with the war in Iran? Will it strengthen or enlarge or weaken the Accords? So I will get onto that in a minute, Austin, because I do think that's a very important question on the wider region. But basically, we need to the short answer is that I think it's actually done a lot of good for the Accords, because before this, if you were listening to my show from a few weeks ago on where Saudi Arabia is at, Saudi was not looking very pro-Israel, and that was partly because they were not scared of Iran anymore. And now that Iran is busy shooting missiles, they might rethink that position, or at least hopefully they will. So that's a short answer. I think there are some wider regional dynamics, and we need to address those. But before we do, we need to figure out what's going on inside Iran and why that is important. So as I said, America doesn't have the option to send large numbers of troops on the ground. You could do special forces in and out, certain kinds of things. You could also, as I said, you can also degrade the security services, which are important. So the Israelis have actually been focusing on that now. Now that they're sort of somewhat done with the missile sites and the nukes, they've actually been blowing up police stations. Also something, there's paramilitary groups called the Basij, of which there's a couple hundred thousand of those, and their headquarters are being smithereened. That kind of stuff is all being done at the moment. So, and the IRCG headquarters. So the Israelis are trying to disable the security state that is around Iran. But the truth is that regime change here might end up looking more like a marathon and less like a sprint. And if you're interested in this topic, I wrote something about it on a news website called thecommonsense.co.za. I write there, sort of depends on how active things are, but normally a couple times a month I put in something to do with this stuff. And I wrote this article on what are the other options that the Americans have. And so one of the other options is to do nonviolence, right? Obviously, there's lots of bombing and whatever going on, which is fine. You can't stop missiles any other way. But there are, when it comes to putting foreign regimes at bay, there are actually other options that one can use. And so nonviolent options include things like proper sanctions. So, a lot of Iran's money comes through oil. And before this crisis, the currency in Iran had actually gone through the floor. They couldn't get it to work. There was like a gazillion percent in inflation. And this was a big problem. So you need to keep that out. But also it needs to be more targeted. You know, the new guy who's just been appointed as the Ayatollah, he has a very large and a sprawling financial empire all over the world. So he's got nice luxury houses, for example, in Britain, and he has all sorts of interesting stuff in Europe that he's got. So he's got a big shipping company, and this guy is now going to be running Iran, and that sort of thing needs to be targeted as well, so that it's not just the people on the street who are feeling this, but the elites who are stealing money from Iranian citizens. So that's one thing. Another big thing is information, right? We wouldn't be in this position today if we had had information about how many people the Iranians have killed so far. So estimates are in the tens of thousands, but it's a lot less accurate than actually even like the Gazan data, because there were at least two accounts, right? You had what the IDF said, and then you had what the Gazans said, and you could kind of decide if you thought that it should be one, the other, or in the middle. But at least there was some sort of data. The Iranians have basically murdered thousands of people, at least according to their own numbers, and it could be tens of thousands according to others, but we struggle with information because it was difficult to get information out at the time. The Iranians have gotten very good at cutting off the internet. MTN is part of that process through the companies that it works with there in Iran. And as a result, you have this problem that we don't know what was going on during that period completely, because people struggling to get information out about the massacres that were happening in real time. The stuff that we did get out, you could see the body bags and first-person testimony and all this kind of stuff, was done because of Starlink. And even then, with Starlink, there were these jamming signals that were being used, military-grade jammers that were being used against Starlink, and actually Starlink had to do upgrades and stuff to get around those. So there are allegedly close to 50,000 Starlink machines in Iran, and it's a serious, serious penalty. If you are caught with one of those machines, it's 10 years in prison. If they accuse you of espionage with using one of those machines, which they could easily do, then that's it's the death penalty. So Starlink has become a big issue. And one of the suggestions is that, Starlink is expensive. It's something like, I think, close to $500-$600. So in Rand terms, you're talking about 10,000 Rand, something like that, which is a lot of money if your inflation rate is going through the floor. So, and they have to be gotten into the country. You can't just like order it on Temu. So there is a program that's actually smuggling these things into Iran. And also, and what happens is they are moved in, and people can actually purchase them. But what really should be happening and the Trump regime should be doing, or the Trump administration rather, to the regime, is to actually get these Starlink transponders into the country en masse. Cut down the price, get the smuggling operations going, and let's double, triple, quadruple the number of Starlinks so that there's constant internet flow and the regime can't track it. Starlink has also started experimenting with a kind of cell phone type thing where you don't need a proper transponder and the cell phone connects directly to the satellite. I believe that they're actually trying to work with a version of this actually in Zambia at the moment. But if this can work, then everyone's cell phone can connect to Starlink and basically the Iranians can't shut down the internet anymore. So that is a huge help and something which would be very useful. There's also a lot of analog technology that the Americans could be using and aren't to deal with this problem. So Iranians can pick up radio, they can pick up satellite. And for many years, there was something called the Voice of America Persian Edition. And this was supposed to be a program that transmitted into Iran and helped opposition members and helped dissidents get their messages out. Unfortunately, Voice of America has a very checkered past when it comes to the people that it hires. And I'm not just talking about on the Iranian issue. For many years, Voice of America was actually taken over by Stalinist officials at the time when it was started. And it was actually basically transmitting pro-Russian messages instead of anti-Russian. And a similar kind of thing seems to have happened with Voice of America Persian. It's not prepared to be critical of the regime. It won't host opposition Iranian members. It's very heavy on personnel and very costly, but doesn't do all that much. It's also very old school. They don't operate digitally on the internet. They use people who are very uninteresting. Basically, it looks very state propagandary. Otherwise, it could actually be quite interesting if someone actually thought through the idea of how do you talk in Persian. And by the way, the people who do this much better than the Americans are, in bizarrely, actually the Israelis. As anyone who's been dealing with information issues with regards to Israel will know, they are famous for not having fabulous English information skills, but in fact they have been wildly successful when it comes to Arabs and Persians. There's a whole unit in the army that speaks Persian, and they've been actually able, through Twitter mainly, to actually speak directly to inside Iran via their accounts, not only the IDF but also the foreign ministry, and it's been a really successful program. And you could have reformed this thing and made it relevant, but unfortunately, there was a bit of chaos in the American government, and the guy who is actually well suited, like really well, is actually the current ambassador to South Africa, Brent Bozell. He was a media activist, and he got put in charge of all the American radio stations. This is not just Persian; they do a bunch of Arabic and other sorts of things. And he is like a media activist, and he was put in charge of this, so that, you know, he could reform it. But as soon as he did, then Elon Musk took over with Doge, and then they just gutted the whole thing and closed the whole thing down. And then he got reassigned to South Africa. And I don't know if the ambassador is listening, and I think he's a great ambassador. He seems to be getting into things quite nicely. But the truth is, I think she thinks that role would have been really good for him. So the Americans need to get their act together on the information war, if they want to really help the people in there. And the truth is that there is a good history of Americans getting this right. At the end of World War II, Berlin was divided up into four sectors, and at some stage the Stalinist communists were trying to take over, and as a result the Americans put in something called I think it was called Radio in the American Sector or something like that, which became kind of Voice of America later on. But it was a very effective radio station, and eventually actually transmitted into Russia. And by the way, if you're interested in it, there's a great series called Gloria, which is a Portuguese production about a radio freedom station in Portugal, which is a really great, if you like, into your Cold War type spy things. Gloria is glorious. It's fantastic. So well worth watching. But it was very effective. Another good example was with the Solidarity movement in Poland. You had the trade union, which sort of grew up. And the Americans realized that they couldn't undermine Poland, but they could keep Solidarity alive. And they put in printing presses, and they put in papers, and they put in all sorts of things. Basically, you can use deterrence and information together, military deterrence and information together, to be very effective. You can also help to organize the Iranian opposition, right? Iranian opposition, we hear a lot about the Shah and Pahlavi and whatever, but those are all monarchists. Those are all people who are fundamentally interested in restoring the kingship. But you have liberals, you have leftists, you have even theocrats, you have certain kinds of conservatives, you have what's called reformers, all sorts of people who also would like to see this thing toppled, but don't agree necessarily with the Shah. And so the Americans have a bad rep of like trying to place somebody in. That's not what they should do here, but they can play a role in creating an enabling environment for the opposition of Iranians and actually get them talking to one another, creating dialogues and engaging one another so that they can work out their own problems, because that would be really effective and important, because the democratic opposition is going to be needed in that country when things, in case things start to fall apart, and you're going to need them trained to actually deal with this problem going forward. So that is another thing which is like a really important process and something which you need to look at. So those are some of the non-kinetic options. When literally the dust settles on this issue, we're going to need to be able to move the Iran in a direction that would be helpful. And I think that it would be useful to start to look at some of these options where the Americans have been successful in the past. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is 101.9 Chai FM.
Chai FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
I am Benji Shulman, and this is the +972 studio on 101.9 Chai FM, and I hope that you are having a great day out there that you're going very, very well. And if you want to be part of the program, 061-895-1019 is the number to dial, and we will gladly have you on our show to talk about anything that is of importance to you, and I'm sure to us as well. Now, I wanted to move on to another topic today, something which I think was very important, and that is the fact that last week Tera Masiwa Lakota died, and he died, and as a result, we had lots of tributes being paid to him, and quite rightly so, because he was a really big part of really of not just the anti-apartheid movement, but after that as well. I think, and maybe most unfortunately, as the guy who headed up COPE, right? COPE was that breakaway party from the ANC, which then did quite well in one election, but then had lots of issues, and then sort of disappeared off of the political map, more or less. Although it is still around, I think, at a local level. And that's kind of how people remember him. But the guy actually had an absolutely outstanding background as a politician. He started out his career with no less than Steve Biko, where he was at school, and Steve Biko, I think, was slightly older than him. And what happened is that Steve Biko went on to found something called the South African Students Organization, which was what was called Black Consciousness at the time, and it was focused in on a kind of it wasn't anti-white, it was just black pride, if you like, because the apartheid government had told black people that they were inferior and Bantu education and all of that. So he started out with Steve Biko, and it was at the founding of SASO, and then He went to university campuses. He grew up in Catholic schools who were prepared to actually teach him, educate him, which was something that Catholic schools did at the time. And then he went to the university, what we would now call University of Northwest. At the time, it had a different name. I think it was called Turfloop, and he was studying there, and there was some issue with the graduation where they were separating out the parents and the kids according to race, and it got a bit heated, and as a result, a bunch of students got expelled, and he was one of them. And so he then joined SASO full time as a kind of organizer. By then, he had gotten his nickname, which was Terror, which had nothing to do with his political skills, but actually because he was a very good soccer player. He said he didn't really know what that would mean going forward. But anyway, once he got, once he started organizing for SASO, at some point he decided to organize a commemoration or a celebration for the fact that Mozambique had gotten independence. And that was highly, highly and just very illegal at the time. And as a result, he was arrested and sent to Robben Island. Basically, he was sent to Robben Island for organizing an Independence Day organizing committee thing. And he was sent to Robben Island. And when he got to Robben Island, he was still with his black consciousness people. And some of them got very angry because they were like, well, look what white people have already done to us. We need to like adjust our ideology so that we really become anti-white. And he said, no, this wasn't something he wanted to do. And so they hit him over the head with a spade. And the authorities didn't really know what to do with this. So they moved him to a different part of the prison. And that prison, part of the prison, happened to be where the ANC guys were kept, because people were kept separately. And that was how he first met Nelson Mandela. And so he learned with the ANC over a long period, and then was eventually released. And when he was released, he started working with the United Democratic Front, which was really just the sort of ANC in disguise. And what they were doing was promoting democratic freedoms. And at some point, they started a million-person signature campaign. And at another point, they started working on some other stuff. And he got arrested again. And as a result, he actually was supposed to be sent back to the prison once again, but because of a technicality with the judge, they threw out this thing. It was one of the longest trials in South African history, something called the trial, the Delmas trial. And he actually was not, didn't actually end up going to jail, but he did sort of have a bit of a problem. And so he actually, yeah, that's what he basically ended up doing. So he was involved with that. And then at the end of apartheid, he then got on and he helped to build the new parliament. He was the helped to design the National Council of Provinces, which is something you may have heard of, which is it's like our kind of version of the Senate in South Africa. And he was the first head of that. He was a premier of the Free State, became the defense minister for a number of years. And then after Mbeki had his fallout with Zuma, he then was involved with COPE. And it was in that capacity as an opposition member that he also then went to Israel. And there were a number of opposition members who went. And when he came back, he said the thing that people didn't want to hear from the ANC, in that he didn't believe Israel was an apartheid state. And he's maintained that, as well as his other positions, really to his dying day. On October 7th, he was probably the most senior politician to come to something organized by the Zionist Fed after October 7th. It was on October 15th, and he was very key about that position. And so he kept it for really a decade, when it really could have been easier for him to go off and do something else and not take the heat. But once he had decided, and he did interviews and all sorts of things about it, and that really made a big difference when it came to his perspective. And I can remember Naledi Pandor, when she was still the foreign minister, being very angry because he did an interview which got picked up by the Jerusalem Post, where he reiterated this point. So he was very, very close on these issues, and very big friend of the community. And as a result, they were, it was a big deal, and he was close to the community. So he has died, and the funeral will be this week. And for all of the eulogies, I think it's really important that we just say that this was a great South African who died last week and made a huge difference. I'm Benji Shulman. This is 101.9 Chai FM.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is +972, your favorite Jewish current affairs and culture show. Now, I am going to be chatting the last part of the show just about the changing dynamics in the Democratic Alliance. It is the official opposition of South Africa, and it is going through a bit of a change. And that change is two things. First of all, the leader of the party, John Steenhuisen, has said that he will not be running again for the next chapter in the party. He's going to stay on as minister. The other thing is that Helen Ziller, who is the party's federal council chairperson, is going to be going to try and be the mayor of Johannesburg. And so the two big decision-making parts of the party have actually opened up for re-engagement, new people, new blood. And a lot of younger members of the DA have started to push for those positions, as well as a number of others that are going to be available come April when they have their Congress. So the leadership one is actually the easier one. It doesn't look like anybody else has said that they're going to be contesting it, other than Jordan Hill Lewis, who is the mayor of Cape Town. He's young. He's, I think, just under 40, as far as I know. And he has said that if he runs and wins that election, that he will actually, he wants to broaden the appeal of the DA. He wants to be a bit more aggressive towards the ANC in the GNU. And he wants to, you know, do a number of other things and make the party more relatable. Now, when this was tried last time round, which was with Muzi Maimane, instead of growing the party, they actually shrank because they stopped talking to their base. So it's an interesting question. Can the DA actually grow its way out of its current trajectory? And certainly some of that will come with this election towards the end of the year, because they will potentially take over new metros, and people will be able to see how that works. So that's one thing, but they do have to be careful, because sometimes this kind of lack of principle can mean that they get the worst of all worlds, because the people who generally vote for the DA stop, and the new people also don't, and then you get no voters, and that could be a real disaster if you are the leader. And so that's something that Jordan Hill Lewis will have to look after. But he has definitely been an excellent mayor of Cape Town, and someone who has brought some innovation and energy to a post which previously was headed by people like Patricia de Lille, who were completely disastrous. So that's on the leadership side. On the federal chairperson side, so there's an interesting race. Helen's number two, a guy by the name of Ashur Sorupin, is running, and he is literally number two on the list in the party underneath Helen. Extremely smart guy. I think he has two or three master's degrees, currently doing a PhD. He's very, very strong on finance, loves the economy. He is the deputy finance minister, and he's been responsible for some of this budgeting and whatnot. And so he's running against a guy from the Free State. He is the front runner. So the likely front runners are going to be Jordan Hill Lewis and Ashore in those positions. But there are a bunch of other positions which are also being contested. There's a guy, Nicholas Inyati, Celia Brink, Sevire Gavua, who is the I hope I pronounced that right. She's the education minister, and they're all targeting the deputy chairs of different portfolios and aspects of the DA as well. And that will bring a new energy and a new dynamic to the party, which I think will be extremely interesting. So hopefully it's a good change, a new change. Change is always as good as a holiday. And it's time for us to change, because we're going to change over into the next show, because we're come to the end of the show for today. Thank you, everyone who helps put the show together. Pushing the big red buttons today is Craig Vusi on the sound, Dylan Berger, who definitely does something at the station, and to you, dear listener, who joins us every single week, please do join us next week on the Plus 97 Studio.